You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad. Well, hello, Scott. How are you?
I'm all right. Just as I took a slug of my Prosecco there and you asked me a question. Thank you for that, Al. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm really well. I've had an absolutely, I can't think of the words, probably one of the strangest weeks of my life. For a whole host of reasons, but unfortunately I can't tell you any of them.
Oh, God.
It'll all be revealed in the fullness of time.
I know what it is.
What is it?
I know what it is.
What is it?
You got your OBE, didn't you? You did, didn't you? You got your OBE, didn't you?
I didn't.
You got your OBE, didn't you? You got an OBE, didn't you? You
I
got
didn't. An OBE, didn't you? I didn't get an OBE.
Did you not? Why did you not? I thought you lot came as a three.
Well, yeah, but no. I mean, I don't know who nominated them for a new. But well, I presume we're talking about.
Obviously, didn't like you.
Sally Donovan and the good lady Jenny Jones. I think it's because I have a policy of slamming the desk every time I go to the DfE. Whatever meeting I'm in, I have to slam the desk at some point and shout, "This is just not good enough!" And that's not made me any friends.
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe it's just that.
Anyway, I just thought I'd ask.
I think they might have put me up for the JBE, which is the Jester of the British Empire. But I haven't quite formalised that yet. I'm not worried. I'm not worried. Yeah. I don't do it for the glory.
Anyway. No, exactly. But not today, in fairness. But the,
well, that, I've cast dispersions on them, haven't I? Oh, what have I said?
You have, haven't you? You've almost just said that's why they've done it. Well done, you. And if this does make the cut, then it should, because you put in stuff that I've said before, so it's there as your right, mister.
Anyway. This is a terrible
You've got
start.
Thrones to polish now.
I had such high hopes for this podcast. Such high hopes.
I think we're avoiding leading into the subject because we know that it's going to be a cracking conversation.
A cracking conversation. I did have one question.
Cracking conversation.
Cracking question. I did have one question. Yeah, how was your holiday? Because I know you've been away taking some time to reflect and navel gaze. And how was that?
It's been interesting, yes. So I obviously had to, well, I didn't have to, but I took the opportunity to travel with my oldest son when he moved to his little Ameri camp for 3 months, 4 months, however long he's away for, last week.
Scary days.
And I tried to find adoptive parents in the area where I was staying to speak to for our lovely podcast and blogging and all that sort of stuff, but nobody came forward. So, sadly, I had spent the week, well, not the week, but 4 days, lying on a sunbed in Florida instead, on my own.
I mean, the temptation
And I mean on my own.
I know. But the temptation is to make fun of you because you live the life. You have a Saint-Tropez lifestyle, don't you? But it's really, he said, quaffing is Prosecco. But it is important, isn't it? Are you choking?
Well, I have to say that by the time Sunday came round, I really did feel like I'd had a break from work, from family, from everything. And I felt refreshed and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And do you know what? You could do that anywhere, really, couldn't you? It doesn't have to be in Florida. It could be in Britain. It could be anywhere. I think that we just need to, we all need that time now.
Headspace. That's that self-care malarkey, aren't we?
Yeah, it is.
Definitely. Is there any news that we need to reflect on? Oh, there was, yes. We've got a new children's minister. We've lost a children's minister. I feel quite disappointed to see Edward Timpson go. Actually, I'm really disappointed.
I'm very, quite upsetting, actually.
Yeah, I think he was a genuine force for good, and I've spoke to people in the DfE, and they've said, actually, they're good. He may not have been, you know, He may not have been my particular flavour of politician, but I felt like he was the real deal. But that may be controversial. I did say that on Twitter and someone went down my throat, but hey.
Well, not everybody. Yeah, well, but not everybody's going to agree with everybody, aren't they? That's the thing. But, you know, for me, I was quite disappointed that he didn't get his seat. But that's life, isn't it? That's what a democratic state.
You live by the sword, you die by the sword.
And, exactly. So if he's listening, which I'm sure he does, because he's probably got some time on his hands.
I've it on good authority.
So he can listen to our podcast, can he?
Yeah, he can catch up. I had approached him twice to come on the podcast, but nothing ever came of it.
Well, he may know that he's not, you know, I don't know, maybe.
I'll see if I can do that.
Maybe.
I'll see if I can make that happen.
Yeah. But anyway, I wish him well if he's going back to cobbling or whatever it is.
Wish him well. You know, we all need shiny shoes, so I'm sure there's a bright future out there.
We do.
Excellent.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
We'd have had a couple of weeks where we're away. What did you think of the conversation with Annie Crombie? Because I know we haven't really had time to catch up on that, but I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I know. I listened back to it, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I listened to it through the car stereo system of my convertible Mustang that I had in America. So you and Annie and me were blaring out while I had the roof down this Mustang driving down... the 192 in Kissimmee. I was getting lots of looks. I was getting a lot of looks.
I can imagine.
I actually loved that podcast. I loved it. I loved the podcast, actually. And
why?
That particular one, because Annie is like she's just one of those people that I do like speaking to anyway, to listen to some of the ways she describes CVA and voluntary adoption ages, she's so passionate about it. I was really engaged with that podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think she changed my view on a few things. I was kind of, in my head, I had quite a bleak future for voluntary adoption agencies, but she kind of said, no, not at all, and that was really refreshing to hear for her perspective and her insights into what the future holds.
Yeah.
So that was really good. It was really, really positive.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'll tell you what I do like about Annie as well. Wait a minute. I was just going to say, before you cut me off, I was just going to say, the one thing about Annie as well is that she really has, she's a great advocate of the user voice as well. And she's, as part of the CVA stuff, you know, we've both spoken to the CVA now about some of the stuff that we get up to with the DfE in the hope that we can kind of develop on a little bit. So that's come as a result of the CVA, hasn't it? So.
Yeah. She feels like a genuine force for good within the adoption landscape. So that's, I'm really pleased she took the time to speak to us. We'll have to come back to her in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be good.
And definitely.
Now, I spoke to Rachel Staff, and I'd wanted to speak to Rachel for a long time because I read a book and I loved it. And I fear that my interview maybe afterwards I thought, oh, I was just a bit sick of family. Because I was clearly, I loved a book and it came through. But we'll have a listen and then you can tell me how rubbish I was at interviewing her. So I'll say to the tech team, run VT. I've always wanted to say that, run VT. You've got his video test. Right, run VT. Well, hello, Rachel. It's lovely to meet you, and thank you very much for agreeing to speak to me, because some people don't, you know. It's not unusual for people to say they'd rather not.
Okay.
The reason I wanted to speak to you is because of the book I read, Parenting Adopted Teenagers. So could you give me a brief introduction of who you are and what you do?
I'm a social worker by trade. Have been for just over 20 years.
Right.
Which has gone very, very quickly. I started off in child protection and worked in different places in the country, really. But I've worked sort of with children from that beginning point, I guess, of when they come to the attention of social services. And then in the last 12 years, I've specialised at the end of the journey, except, of course, it's not.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Post-adoption support has been my passion, really. And I think that the reason I got into it was because of working with adoptive families within children in need teams and area teams, and not understanding why the children were still having the difficulties they were having so long after they'd been adopted.
Yeah.
And I think in the social work world, what I knew at the time, what I understood at the time, it just didn't make sense to me. So it kind of started this long journey, really, of trying to understand what it is that happens in those early years that means that a child's still really struggling when they're 9, 10, 12, 13. So it was a real sort of, a journey of discovery, really, along the way.
Does that mirror the, a kind of awakening knowledge about adoption support? I mean, I guess it's always been known that children struggle, but do you think that across the wider profession that's you've mirrored a developing knowledge within social work as well?
Definitely. We were just really, I think going back, I mean, this is sort of 15 years ago, I remember working with an adopted boy who was, he must have been about 9, 10 at the time, and just really struggling with the psychotherapist he was working with to figure out what was going on. And I think social work traditionally is quite focused on just looking at the family in the present and trying to figure out, okay, what's going wrong? But that wasn't making any sense. And I was very, very fortunate that at the time I was working in Birmingham and I had a really great manager who sent me on some training. And then I just went on more training. And I did the trauma attachment training with Family Futures.
Right.
And then so on and so on. And sort of gradually built up this knowledge base along with everybody else, really, about the impact of any trauma. And the fact that it doesn't go away, doesn't disappear.
Well, that's really interesting that you've charted that course professionally. I read your book, which is Parenting Adopted Teenagers, which is, I have to say, I do read a lot of books, and some books are very dull. I have to say, yours is not one of those books, and I'm not just being sycophantic. I found it really just interesting, and it was kind of a relief to read that someone felt like they were on the same page as me. And that was the focus of our conversation, David. So if you don't mind, I'm going to move you on to that. Okay, tell me what is going on in a normal, if I use that word guardedly, a normal teenage brain.
Well, it's a tricky time. It's a challenging time in terms of development. I think that everybody's familiar with the kind of whole idea of teenage angst and things, but I think the neurological understanding that people like Dan Siegel have really brilliantly illustrated in recent years gives us a kind of much clearer understanding of what that's actually about for teenagers. You're going through huge changes in terms of your brain development, really, during that period. I mean, it runs between 12 and kind of 25, although often when I say that to parents they panic, and then I say, but it's not a static process. What your brain's doing at 14 is very different to what your brain's doing at 23, but it's just this rapid period of change in the brain, really. And it's challenging enough for teenagers without any trauma. But when you have teenagers who have experienced really tricky times in their early years, it gets much harder. So for your average teenager, if you like, I really like Dan Siegel's explanation of the different qualities of mind that are present in the teenage years. So your brain, you have an increased intensity in novelty seeking.
Yeah.
And it's developmental, it's necessary, it's what we need in teenagers.
Yeah.
Because you're kind of preparing to step out into the world. So you need to be able to take more risks, you're actively seeking things out in the world. You know, it kind of gives a real kind of sense of vitality and curiosity, I think, to lots of teenagers. Social engagement, teenagers are much more concerned with their peers, very aware of what other people are thinking of them. wanting to go out and engage more in the world. And again, you kind of need to because you're preparing for adulthood. So the brain is doing something very, very useful for us in that way during that time. Just like more intense emotions, much more concerned with the meaning of life, where do I fit into it? All of that kind of stuff is just intrinsic really to the teenage experience. And that can bring lots and lots of positives, but it also brings lots of lots more challenges for young people, you know? So with novelty seeking comes risk taking. You know, terrifying to parents.
Yeah, I'm laughing.
I think we all remember probably in our own teenagers. I certainly do.
Yeah. I was thinking more of myself, actually, the things I did. But we'll not talk about that. We'll not focus upon that.
It's necessary. You know, you've got to go out and take risks if you're going to move from childhood towards adulthood, you know. But with social engagement, it's if you are a teenager who's doing quite well, you build up a network of peer support. And that's really important. When you're kind of moving away from your parents a bit, because they don't replace those attachments, but they become a kind of substitute for you out there in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So teenage friendships are very intense and also really important.
So you've painted a picture of quite a, well, it is a turbulent time, and I think everyone would quite freely accept that, reflecting on their own experience and perhaps their children's experience. So into that mix, we're throwing early life experience. And I'm thinking of what I see on Twitter and Facebook and talking to my adoptive parents' friends. They kind of say, wow, this is an interesting time. So what is added to the mix that you've described that makes it different again?
Well, I think if you think of those four qualities of mind that Dan Siegel describes, and then you add in the impact of early trauma, if you think about novelty seeking, the downside of that is risk taking. If you've had an early history of trauma, there are lots of reasons why that might be more risky and more worrying for parents and for young people themselves, actually. Teenagers don't make great judgments in terms of balance, but you'll go with on balance, the 20% say of that risk being worth it. So we might stand at the top of the hill and think about riding a bike down it as adults and think, the likelihood is 80% chance that I'm going to fall off. A teenager will think, well, there's 20% chance I won't fall off, so I'll do it anyway. Kind of necessary for that stage of development. But if you're a young person who's had very unsafe experiences early in life and you don't have great maybe cause and effect thinking, if that hasn't developed fantastically for you, if you are someone who feels quite unsafe in themselves, you're more likely to take risks.
Right.
If you're a teenagers anyway don't have that great prefrontal cortex development. It's not very online. So that's the bit of our brain that kind of does the balancing out the reason. So maybe this isn't a very good idea. It kind of inhibits emphasis. Young people who have been through a lot of early trauma are probably entering teenage years without that being very well integrated in the first place. So you then add that into the mix of what teenagers do in terms of novelty seeking and risk taking, and you've got a young person who's quite compromised in their ability for that kind of upper brain to monitor, if you like, those kinds of influences and what's going on. So young people who don't have great peer relationships, who can't really make great social judgments, are more likely to take risks to impress peer group.
I mean, that's a common theme, as people say, they choose the friends, you know, that you wouldn't choose. And that puts you, like you say, puts you in a vulnerable position.
Yeah. And I think with, you know, with the social engagement part of teenagers, the brain is really, really focused on that need to connect more with peers, but also the awareness of what other people might think of them. If you are a young person who's got low self-esteem or who has never quite got to the point of being able to form good peer relationships before that point, you're going to struggle because you're already entering that really wobbly phase with a kind of compromised capacity. So lots of people I work with, they don't have the, they don't get the nuances, the complexity of it all. And it can be quite brutal in teenagers. And that's really hard for them because just as they're trying to fit in, and they really need to fit in to feel okay about themselves, their peer group is likely to be quite judgmental and critical of them.
So that's the worst possible combination, isn't it?
Yeah, because you don't have this cushion of supported friends whilst you're kind of beginning to separate from your parents.
Mm.
So it kind of gets a bit confused and a bit messy.
Yeah. You're not painting a very happy picture. I'm not really. I mean, my children are now, my children are 24, 20, 21, 12. So my older children negotiated quite well. They're all adopted, negotiated quite well. My younger children are not. I can see that there's an element of immaturity that is a terrible combination with them being put into a school environment where the nuances of social interactions are just off the scale, teenage playground conversations, and like you said, so that's really interesting. So what, I mean, on a basic level, what can parents do in those situations? Well, I mean, what is a broad strategies for helping young people and children? Well, young people.
I think that, the best advice I can give really is the advice that the adoptive parents I've worked with have given to each other.
Right.
From their own experiences in the group, in the group that I worked with for a number of years, and what they would say, and you fully agree, is to try and give the child a structure around peer relationships that may well be directed at a much younger child.
Right.
So, excuse me, for some young people, they're just not going to manage unstructured peer time.
Yeah.
So outside of school, they're more likely to benefit from things like guides or scouts or Navy cadets or...
So regimented is too strong a word, but things that have really clear ends, finishes and interactions in between.
Yeah, kind of clear expectations, the availability of an adult to regulate what's going on within that peer group, I think is really important, because if you've got a child who can't do the nuances and who is going to either aggravate peers or withdraw socially from peers, having that adult brain alongside to kind of notice, to fill in gaps for them.
And does it help that that adult isn't you, in the sense that there's... Right. That was my next question. Why do you think that is?
During teenage years, we are individuating, we're separating.
Right.
So we think our parents are embarrassing. They know absolutely nothing.
I'm nodding my head.
Something a teacher says, they may come home and say, wow, this teacher said this to me today. And you may be thinking, hang on, I said that 2 days ago. But this is the nature of it. And I think that's really, really hard for parents because it can feel very rejecting, and that kind of kickback against your values and your understanding of the world and what you do is a pretty painful process during adolescent years. Parents knowing it's normal can help. But I think with adopted young people, it's harder because they often they've lost time, if you like, in terms of forming that secure attachment relationship before they get to teenagers. A child who's placed with their parents or parent at 6 or 7,
there's the gap.
They're kind of behind the starting point. And so we would not expect a seven-year-old to be ready to be doing all of that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need you anymore, and, you know, stay out of my life, and all of that kind of normal teenage stuff, which children who are securely attached and have had enough time can do. But the young people who either haven't had enough time or are still carrying those insecure early attachment styles with them, which come to the fore in adolescence, that not wanting your parent around carries much more than just the kind of dismissiveness that teenagers who don't have that can do it with. Because they're not ready to do what their brain is telling them to do, if you like.
And do you think that, which is a normally it's a healthy kind of process, isn't it, where we make that separation. But do you think that that's a particular difficulty for some adoptive parents as well, because they're playing catch up too. They've missed 7 years, and all of a sudden, within a blink of an eye, you know, if you adopt a child at 7, 5 years later, they're starting to separate, and then that, ouch.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that it's, you know, for lots of young people, that need to separate and individuate gets a bit muddled with also needing to make sense of their birth identity too.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're, you know, a young person who doesn't have that background, it's kind of simpler. Oh, my parents really get on my nerves, you know, I don't want to be around them. For a young person who's thinking, oh, I'm feeling all this conflict, I feel like I want to be away from my parents, and often there's other stuff coming into that where they're thinking, well, you know, where do I belong then? You know, do I feel like this about my parents because actually maybe I'm more like my birth family? Do they have another to make sense of alongside those very normal feelings?
Yeah, because I was going to talk to you about identity, and then you've started that already. But how do you think that young people kind of are trying to make sense of their identity at that time? You know, there's an influence of birth parents in that as well, isn't there? And adoptive parents about timings and life story work, which is, I know, something else that you work a lot on as well, don't you? Life story work. So how does it all interplay at this time?
I think it comes to a peak in adolescent years, really, because, you know, that kind of quality of mind of creative exploration is really driving the young person to... We've got abstract and conceptual thinking all of a sudden. You know, what's the meaning of life? Who am I? What does this mean? You know, they've got to kind of do it again. Most young people that I've worked with have some memories of birth family. You know, most adoptive parents are fantastic at doing that drip-drip approach of life story work, if you like, as the child grows up. So they will know often the facts of their story. They will know how they came to be adopted. They will know their adoption story, the story of their family. But when they get to teenagers, and often their behaviour is quite difficult, often their emotions are all over the place, they're often trying to make sense of, is this about me being adopted? Is this about what happened to me? If I'm an angry, stroppy young person, for example, does this mean I'm like the angry, stroppy birth dad that I've been told about or read about?
That's a reasonable question to ask, isn't it?
Yeah. If I'm getting into trouble, because for all sorts of reasons I'm unhappy, there's all sorts of stuff going on and I'm in kind of some criminal behaviour, does that mean that I'm like, you know, they will fill in the gaps. Often they're changing physically quite a lot in teenage years. They're wondering about who they look like. Loss is a big theme in teenagers. You know, for every teenager, loss is a theme, but for adopted young people, it's kind of with bells on, and often they're thinking anew about do their birth families still think of them? they're wondering about more in depth about the whys of what happened. You know, why couldn't they look after me? You know, why couldn't they change in time? You know, what made them like that? And what makes you like this?
Really difficult questions to answer, aren't they?
Big question.
And I remember with my eldest daughter, I remember almost a palpable light bulb moment in her as a teenager, whereas, like you said, we would drip feed information, but there came a moment where there was no more information to give, because it was revelation she needed, and she had that moment where she, with an adult mind, she understood what the story was. And up until then, it had just been, you know, euphemisms, but then all of a sudden, crikey, with an adult mind, she had a moment of revelation, and she was distraught. She'd finally joined the dots that only she could join. And that's really hard to help your child make sense of that.
And it's really scary for parents too, because in that kind of maelstrom, if you like, often of the questions that young people have, or the feelings they have about that, when they can't verbalise them clearly, often they come out in very angry, rejecting statements towards their parents. And often parents hold those fears about what's going on with my child. Is this about genetics? Is this about birth identity? Is this about, you know, what's going on?
Is history repeating itself in this life?
And often parents find that really hard to say. They feel very guilty about that. But, you know, these are things that it's really important to talk about when you're working, you know, from our perspective, when you're working at the family, because it's all normal within a normal range of the experience, really. And I think that all of the adoptive parents I've worked with have had those commonalities of experience, of this almost parallel process, really, alongside their children. You know, teenagers are really difficult for adopted young people often. They're equally as difficult, if not more, sometimes their parents. Yeah. They're trying to be there for their kids whilst they're going through this.
But there's also an impact on them. And I think I'm going to plug your book here. I think the thing that really made me enjoy your book was there's a sense of, this wasn't a book about teenagers, this was a book about parents and teenagers, and it constantly drew you back to how this may make you feel, this as a parent, how this may impact on you, because adopters have their own story. I mean, everyone has their own reason why they adopted, and the loss that maybe is woven into that story and heartache, and this could be just the wrong moment to get your teenager to turn around and say, "Oh, you hate me, Alice, you've never adopted me, you're the worst parent in the world, and I'd be much better if I'd stayed with my parents." And you want to go, "Oh, well, just get lost and go back then." But you can't admit that, can you? Or can you?
No. Well, I think, you know, I really hope that the way we work, and I know that the parents group I work with, is that people, giving people permission to say what they feel ashamed to say, releases a huge burden. I don't think we're great generally in our wider culture of parenting generally about talking about the reality of the challenges of parenting and the way parents may feel about their children sometimes. And I think it's there's an awful lot of shaming that goes on.
We're onto a sensitive issue, aren't we?
But you know, lots of adoptive parents I've worked with have just felt this huge level of shame, because I mean, usually they're with us because there are difficulties, you know, so social services have got involved or whatever, and you know, they're really worried about, have they failed as parents? You know, my child's struggling, so I can't have done a good enough job. You know, it's often the undercurrent they're coming with. So for me, normalising and talking about the reality of that role and what that means is really, really important. if we shame parents when they talk about the honesty of their feelings, how are we supposed to help?
Yeah. And I've heard parents say, I feel like I'm living with the birth parent.
Yeah.
And that's a really tricky conversation for them to have, and how to respond to that in a way that doesn't judge. Because actually, yeah. Some, you know, it is a tricky time, isn't it? This teenage moment where everything's in flux for everybody. I mean, where do people go to for support? Where would you send people?
I mean, I think there's lots of good support around. I mean, we're in London, so I guess London has quite a heavy concentration of agencies, as well as CAM services, as well as the Tavistock, as well as the Maud's. You know, that there's quite a kind of high concentration, I would say, down here. I think generally, you know, as a first point of contact, I think post-adoption teams are really important. They should be informed about the impact of early trauma in adolescence. If they're not, they should learn. I think that one of the questions I would like to see on with initial intake teams, with safeguarding teams, is a question on the referral form: is the young person adopted?
Well, that's really interesting. You say that.
If so, speak to the post-adoption team, because there will be a whole other level of assessment needed here.
Yeah, and there's a story. There's a story before you even get to the story, isn't there?
Absolutely. And if you're not understanding that story, you're not understanding the young person, and you're not understanding the family.
So is that something you see, that that families get drawn back into that child protection system?
Yes. You know, some of the young people that I've certainly worked with in London have come to the attention of local authorities because they're on the edge of gangs, or they're at risk of being groomed, or there's been that family relationships are just really, really difficult, or they've got into criminal behaviour. So if those young people come into the social work system without anybody acknowledging or thinking about what might be the impact of early trauma here, then the risk is that, A, you're misunderstanding the child's needs, you risk that, but also, you know, adoptive parents often end up feeling shamed by the focus of social services on their family in the now. And I think that's, for me, that's inexcusable when the knowledge is out there. And, you know, I know it's not always the case, but really, in terms of those messages about the impact of early trauma in teenagers, they're there, they're available. You know, if post-adoption teams could be aware of them, then maybe the beginning to explore what's going on for a child would be better informed and often less punitive for the adoptive families going through that process. You know, if CAMS varies widely, you know, in terms of access to support, it really is, I know it's a bit of a lottery, but we have to stop shaming people early on in that process if they're going to be brave enough to look for support.
Yeah, it's a really, I mean, it seems like a more prevalent issue than ever. And I don't know whether that's because the cohort of adoptees has sort of been boiled down to the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, 40 years ago, it would be a small slither of the adoptee community, but now it seems to be, it's more than 20%, and it's maybe more than 30%. But a question that I did get asked to ask you was, does it end?
Adolescence ends. Yes, most of us.
I'm not going to hold you to it.
It does. I think what it feels like at 14 is very different to what it will feel like at 20 or 21.
Right. And is there hope? I mean, it's all bad, but teenagers can be fantastic as well.
They're amazing. I mean, I love working with teenagers. And, you know, teenagers in adoptive families have, for me, have the best chance of moving forward to a healthier adulthood. The blessing for me in adoptive families is that it is forever. The attachment relationship is there forever. And that is the most important thing for those young people. If you have a family who are thinking about you, who hold you in mind, who are there for the long run, who can weather that storm, then those young people are in such a better position than young people who are, say, in insecure foster care arrangements, you know, or something like that. It's the relationship. In the end, it's the relationship that is keeps things going.
Yeah, I mean, we've one of my daughters really struggled, and now she's into her 20s, and the struggle's eased. It was rocky. Saying it nicely, but it eased, and it's easing, and it continues to ease us. I think we relax a little bit and she matures a little bit. There's, you know, there's certainly an element of we've learned a lot about ourselves and how we could have perhaps acted differently. But there is hope, isn't there? It's got to be hope.
There is definitely hope. And, you know, from a professional perspective, the best time for me, one of the best times to work with children is in adolescence. You know, the brain is rapidly changing and evolving, and for that reason, it's, you know, the plasticity that's there in that time means that, you know, in the crisis there's also opportunity. And if we can support young people and support their parents, importantly, to support them, the, you know, the future can be a really positive one. You know,
so there's a capacity to repair. And
absolutely for sure,
because that this was a quote from your book: with sufficient support, this challenging state of development also presents an opportunity for hope and change.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I broke my cardinal rule and I underlined it in your book, but I did it in pencil so I can rub it out if I have to.
That's very disciplined.
But that is, it does give hope, doesn't it, that actually it's an opportunity to perhaps adjust some stuff and realign some stuff.
Do you know, if you've got a young person who's really struggling with and trying to make sense of their relationship with their parents, that's a great opportunity to help them make sense of it.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's, if they're asking, who am I, what does all this mean, then what better opportunity to support them with that? You know, for all of the outpouring, you know that you at least know they need it.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a struggle going on, it's a clear signal that that family needs help. And adoptive parents, I think they need the support of other adoptive parents. I think that's really, really important. But I think they need professionals who are accepting of the reality of the struggle they're going through, who understand adolescence and trauma, and who can be alongside them in it. You know,
that's a fantastic message, and it, and I'm aware that at 35 minutes I've talked to you. I've taken up loads and loads of your time. So that's a really positive message to end on, really, isn't it? That actually, for all of the turmoil, there is hope. And
absolutely.
Yeah. Was there anything you'd like to say? Final parting comments?
I suppose the thing that I'm always saying is a plea for understanding, really, from professionals in the widest sense possible, of A, what adolescence means, B, what trauma in adolescence means, and a willingness to support those families. It doesn't need to be intensive, it doesn't need to be long-term, but it needs to be there in a readily available and accessible way.
That's a great message. Well, thank you very much for your time. And your book is available from all major booksellers, isn't it?
Apparently so.
Have you sold many?
I don't know, actually. I'm waiting to hear from Jessica Kingsley.
Oh, they've kept the royalties. We heard it here first. Wow. Those black-hearted characters. Hey, well, thank you very much for your time, and I really appreciate your conversation, and I'd love to speak to you again in the future.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was the interview with Rachel. What did you think of all that then?
Well, like we've talked about, I kind of know of Rachel because she used to work in the team that placed my children, my older two. A lot of the stuff that she said just clicked. It just clicked in my head. Yes, 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 yes. Yes, yes.
It's
very, refreshing. Very, very right what she's saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For someone actually to get it as well and to be able to say, actually, that happens because of this. You don't hear that very often, do you? You know, if you're, and as a parent of teenagers, you know, it's often the professionals think that you know those children best, but actually sometimes you just need that little bit of help to be able to work out how to help them. And you know, it's easy to sit there and say, well, I know my children best, or you know your children best, or
yeah,
whatever, but actually sometimes you just need that little bit of extra,
someone to kind of make sense of what's going on for you.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, we don't always do that as parents, do we? So
no, I mean, I think the thing that I did like about a book was that it was about adopted teenagers, but it was also about parents, in that it, and I think that came strongly through, that she really understood the plight of parents. And it's a tricky time anyway, but for those of us who've adopted or fostering, there's an awful lot more going on. And that's encouraging, just like you said, that someone gets it. There's a few things that she picked up that I was wanting to ask you about. One of them was, which I thought was really insightful, and you know, I sort of said, well, what can we do? And she said, sort of getting them into structured organisations and providing them with alternative adults to look up to. And I thought, yes, that makes sense of some of the stuff that we've stumbled into, because we're not very bright. Things like football, which I'm like the least football-y person in the world. But actually, for Flossie, she there's adults there, the coaches and people who just are keeping her on the straight and narrow, and they're working with us, and they understand her, and they understand the challenges, and they're kind of just going, oh, don't worry, I'll sort her out. Don't worry, I'll keep her on track. And they can do it for a few hours. So is that something similar to you? I know you've had quite structured teenage years for your boys, haven't you?
Yeah, we really have, and yes, it has worked. I think that my only small issue with stuff like that is about the attachment thing, and it's about, I guess it may be a little bit different for us as well, because obviously we're a same-sex couple, so one of our sons will attach to a female very quickly and have almost like a kind of parental relationship with them, which, you know, it's not in school, but in other kind of sort of settings, if you like. And that's really the only thing that kind of got me thinking from that was about that, in terms of where there's quite not an extreme attachment issue, but, you know, where there is an attachment issue, and keeping that kind of separate, because it's all very well them being able to deal with the behaviours and stuff like that, but they also need to understand that some of it is quite false in terms of the, I guess, the things that the young person might say to them might not be kind of the whole truth sometimes.
You've got to have
that. That sounds a bit wobbly, I know, but...
No, but I can recall as a teenager really sort of leaving my parents and becoming fixated with my friend's parents, and they just became like surrogate parents. So in some ways that's a healthy thing.
Yeah.
But like you say,
yeah,
having that link to that person as a parent, saying, you know, guiding them through the mind of our child. Is that a nice way of putting it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's probably the right way to put it, actually. And I think that comes down to the relationship you might have with, you know, as a parent with those adults, to make sure that they do understand that, you know, it's not your normal kind of... but that doesn't apply to them all, I know that. And,
yeah.
You know, that's just kind of one of my experiences of it. But it's very true, because actually they can make a little bit of a difference. And, you know, I've seen it with kind of motivation of both of the teenagers in terms of things that they want to do. If we say to somebody, you're going to do this, it's a, I'll do it when I want to do it. And, you know, they stomp up to their bedroom, slam the door, and the music gets blaring, and you don't see them for the rest of the night. But actually, when it's mentioned to them by someone else, it's like, oh, yeah. And they're actually willing to give them the help to get to that point where they're ready to do it, rather than having a big old blazing row about it. So, yeah, it's right. It's just that little bit and kind of the potential attachment to that person. Course, if they don't get the children's, if they don't get the young person's emotional needs, then sometimes that can go wrong as well.
And it's very flattering, you know, isn't it?
When they kind of detach themselves.
Yeah.
It can be. And that's, you know,
that's...
But, you know, totally, totally true what you said. Totally true.
Yeah. And I think it reinforces that idea that, you know, total kudos to single carers, because you think we need teams around our children, the children that are the ones that are at the wobbly end of the spectrum. Nice euphemism.
Yeah.
But I am conscious that we are, you know, as a family unit, we have three adults in the house, and I have two adult children who really help, and I don't think we would manage. And that's, I'm just thinking about the care of one of our children.
Mm.
There's a team of people who just get us through every day. There's people we can draw on, adults who can step in, and they will accept advice and guidance from. So that was good. That was one thing. The other thing she said about was about risk, and I thought, yeah, that's exactly right. You know, that you and me were a similar age. We look at things and go, that's going to turn out badly, and our kids go, that's going to turn out great. And you go, oh, please. I had this conversation with Flossie the other night at 9:30. She said, I'm going out. And I said, well, you're not. It's 9:30. And she said, she was in a pyjama. She said, I'm going to cycle. She was going to cycle somewhere. And she was going to go on a dual carriageway, 9:30 in a pyjamas on a bike. And I was going,
oh, my days.
That's not going to happen.
Nothing.
And, you know, you can imagine how the story unfolded. And we laughed and we cried. Yeah. And then you think she has no, the concept of risk is just, I just see the blue flashing lights, but she doesn't get it.
Yeah. I don't think any of them do, actually.
No.
In that respect, I think, no, they don't. I would struggle to think of one example on that, because there's so many.
It's just
so many examples.
A stream of risk-taking.
Yeah, exactly. It's our normal. It's our normal, because we, as attached and, I would say, kind of, you know, minimally traumatized people, because obviously everybody experiences some trauma in life, but, you know, we're always doing risk assessments before we try and do something, but no, they just don't. They just don't do it. And, you know, but that is our normal as a family, I feel. You know, we're always constantly having to do the risk assessment, and then having to do the kind of talking down, and then have the argument, and then have the, you know, like you say, the laugh, the cry, you know, all that sort of stuff, and then at the end of it, as if to say, you know, for us to go, oh my God, did that really happen?
Did we?
And yes, it did. And it happened yesterday, and it happened earlier today, and it happened the day before, and, you know, it's just,
that's it's normal. Ongoing, isn't it? But
And you can only hope that, you know, with constant kind of reminding of things, and, you know, I feel, and I know Jacob's not a teenager yet, but with him, you know, even crossing the road, it took us a good 18 months to get him to look both ways before he even thought to step off the curb, you know. And I remember when we fostered him, that was the one thing that I had to put in every report, was that he, number one, he had no stranger danger awareness, and he still probably doesn't, actually, in a lot of ways, and he just could not cross the road. Could not cross the road from Toffee. to the point where we had to, you know, go everywhere with them.
And that's a huge pressure on a parent, isn't it? Especially when it's not age related. I mean, you accept that from a 3-year-old or a 4 or even a 5, 6. But beyond that, it's you just kind of instinctively think that those should be there. But it's a huge pressure on a parent if you're risk assessing every single thing.
Yeah, and you see
all the time your child on that cusp of danger, of really inappropriate decisions in relation to their own physical safety, emotional safety, financial.
Yeah,
no, exactly. Don't do that with your money. Mm-hmm. Oh, you've done it with your money. You know, those well-worn paths that we all see on Twitter every week.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that as well, you know the cycle of things. So, you know, with one of my older ones, we see a cycle with his female acquaintances. We know how that's going to go. It happens every time. It has not changed in the last 6-7 years. It's exactly the same cycle. We could actually set our calendar by it when he starts a new relationship. And the same when he goes out of a Saturday night. You know, we know that he's going to spend a certain amount of money on his first drink, and then his second drink is going to be for him and a friend, and then his third drink is going to be him and whoever else has turned up. And it's him that's paying for the drinks all night. And that we can see before he even goes out. And we know he's not going to be home by the time that he agrees. And we know he's going to be out until exactly this time in the morning. But, you know, if you challenge or question before that happens, it results in the same thing because he doesn't see the kind of the risk that he's putting himself on.
Yeah, and can't see that pattern. I mean, we had similar with Flossie now that she's kind of got a bit more independence. But just that desire to spend on friends. She's getting older. It's a way of maintaining friendships and maintaining relationships and kind of garnering favour. And she would bankrupt herself. You know, and it's not funny, but she was trying to sell a desk to Lottie the other day. And she's going, you know, so Lottie was going, she said I could have a desk for £2. What world is this normal? You know, that our children are bartering over furniture.
That actually they don't even know them, so, you know.
Yeah. It's my flipping desk anyway. Yeah, it's worth at least £3.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I want a coat.
Yeah.
That's not funny.
No, it's not, but, you know, you have to laugh at it, because if you didn't, oh my days.
It's fun. So that was a good interview, great interview, and I think I really would encourage people to buy the book, because I think the book really is... It's an easy read as well. It's not one of those kind of dull academic books. It rattles along. It's a good story.
Yeah.
It's no pictures, though.
I think you said that a couple of times in the interview as well.
Did I mention that? Yeah. I should be on commission.
Yeah, I think you did. I've actually got the book because I was asked to review it when it first came out. So I agree with you. It's a cracking read.
That leads me into a lovely segue book. Because I've just spoken to a publisher and they're going to send me some books for us to review. But clearly, you and I are far too lazy. I think it's probably the right word.
Close.
Yeah. Dim.
See, I wouldn't have said lazy.
So I'm seeing if I can find someone who's who's much more clever and that than what we is. And is good with them words. Mm-hmm. So I might have approached Suddenly Mummy to do that for us.
Oh, I mean, she doesn't do anything else all day, so you might as well.
As she said, she's got no life and she loves to read books. So,
Fair enough.
Yeah, so I'm waiting.
I think that actually, I was just going to say from her perspective, actually, it'd be nice to have a little bit of a kind of, another chat with her.
Yeah,
and at some point, perhaps, and if she's going to,
It would add the feminine touch to the podcast, I feel. Because it's just oozing with testosterone, isn't it?
I'm not even going to go there.
No, don't go there.
Otherwise, we'll have that explicit rating again, and we don't want that.
Which leads me nicely to my next question, which is... What's you up to now?
I knew you were going to do that. It's not just what's you up to now, it's hashtag what's you up to now.
Hashtag.
He's very quiet.
I think he's gone shy.
I think he's cottoned on to the fact.
Yeah, he has. I think he's cottoned on to the fact that we made it a bit of a feature.
Did we mention the fish? That I saw him with a fish. Did you see him with a fish?
No.
Oh, yeah,
no,
fish.
I didn't see him with a fish.
He'd been fishing. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Where does he get the time? He's retired, of course. Yeah. I forgot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a picture of him on a bike as well.
Well, that's interesting. I'm going to have to... With the fish on the back. I tell you, I know exactly what Hugh's been up to now.
What's he been up to?
I can tell you. So, because you're right, he's obviously been doing his cycling. And he did 10 laps of Richmond Park on Saturday.
Did he?
And he earned 17 beer tokens he earned.
Did he?
There you go. Yeah.
Well, maybe next time I see him, I could cash him in. I'm seeing him next month, so that'd be exciting.
Well, there you go then. Yeah,
I'll report back to you. So that's what's Hugh up to. That's very good.
But to be honest, I've been so busy doing his job, I've not had a chance to really catch up with this. Or part of his job, not all of his job.
Taking
part
up
of his
the
job.
Slack that he's, yeah, a lot of slack.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's very good. So, right. 1 minute, you've got 1 minute. What are you doing in the next couple of weeks? Are you busy?
I've got a quiet week next week, and then the week after I'm busy, and then I don't know.
That's exciting. What an exciting life you live. We're busy. We're talking on the 5th.
We've got an 8th.
We're talking.
5th. We are on the 5th.
And then on the 12th, yes, which is most exciting. We're 12th, we're doing for We Are Family at Islington Town Hall. Check our websites, our Twitter feeds, our Facebook pages.
Blah, blahs, or blah, blahs.
This, or that, and Instagram, all of that.
Exactly, stuff,
Everyone's welcome. It's free. And Scott, you'll be signing autographs of yourself, won't you?
Of myself?
Yeah, signed autographs, pictures of yourself. Not yourself, that's weird. Pictures of yourself, you'll be signing them.
I think you've got me confused with... You've got me confused with someone else, I think.
Have you? All right, okay. That's fine. It sounds like we've both got very busy weeks. So I'm going to... I think that's it.
We've always got busy weeks, haven't we?
Yeah. Anything else you want to say?
Bye.
No?
No, that's it.
Okay. Well, on that note...
I think our banter's dried up tonight.
It has dried up. I mean, it's a rich and varied tapestry of conversation.
Is this the end?
This is the end.
What episode are we on?
This might be episode 20.
Oh, well, I see. There you go. That's it. Finished.
Okay.
No more podcasts.
Nice while it lasted.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
See you next
time. Thanks for listening.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
'Cause just leave it like that, and everybody's going to freak out. They're serious.
Do you really think that people are that bothered? I know my mum downloads it.
Yeah.
Other than that,
yeah,
it'd be fine.
Tris, do you listen to our podcast or not?
Yeah.
Oh, Tris listens to it as well. So there's 20 downloads.
Yeah. I think they're called pity downloads. It's a thing.
Yeah. Do you download them because you pity us, or?
No, it just helps him watch paint dry.
Oh, he says it's handy when he's watching paint dry. Keeps him on fire.
Oh, he's cut me deep. He's cut me deep.
Oh, dear.
It's fun.
Oh, well.
Anyway.
Never mind, eh?